From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the DIA director reacts to Detroit creditor Syncora's settlement with the city.
I did, from a very unlikely source, was tipped off a couple of weeks ago that Syncora was giving up on the notion that the collection would be sold.
As Michigan businesses complain they can't find workers with the skills they need, is there another side to this skills gap?
When you look at the package that employers have put together to attract people to the industry, it ain't so great.
Plus, do you love the online quest for a sweet travel deal? You might be wasting your time.
People may not know, but a lot of these companies are just a few companies and they own each other.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Employers claim there is a skills gap in Michigan. They say they can't find enough workers with the skills to fill the jobs they have. But really, how true is that? I'm Cynthia Canty. Is the skills gap a myth? That question today on Stateside. And then troubling times ahead for Michigan's bird population. But first, all throughout the Detroit bankruptcy battle, there has been intense debate over the Detroit Institute of Arts, whether the DIA can and should be forced to sell its works to help offset Detroit's insolvency. DIA Director Graham Beal recently wrote a letter that was published in the museum's newsletter, and then it was posted on Deadline Detroit under the headline, Museums Should Step Very Carefully in Times of Crisis. Graham Beal is with us now. Graham, your letter describes the way the Delaware Art Museum sold three of its most notable artworks to pay off debts it ran up because of an expansion program. Now, it is clear you don't think that sale should have happened, but some argue it had to be done to keep the museum alive. Do you think there were other options that could have been explored?
There usually are. When this kind of thing happens, the Association of Art Museum Director gets involved. And in the two cases that have happened in the past couple of years, people running the museum have basically not paid any attention to our the AAMD's very, very strongly held belief that you do not sell works of art for any other purpose than to acquire more art and to enhance the collection.
Over this past year and a half since this bankruptcy battle began, I'm wondering what kind of conversations, Mr. Beal, you've had with your peers, with directors at other major museums, about the situation with the DIA and the city of Detroit.
I haven't. There hasn't been a lot to discuss, really. I mean, there's been all the press and media attention to the collection as if it was going to be sold tomorrow, which would never have been the case. And my colleagues understand the situation here. They understand that we took draconian steps in 2008 to bring our budget down by 30% and operate within our means before we were able to get the millage passed to support our operations. And as I say, there isn't a lot to say, actually. We all know that you don't sell art to pay other kinds of bills. And that is the standard that I've always adhered to, and it's the reason that I was outspoken when the National Academy of Design decided to sell works of art to solve its financial problems, which it seems not to have done, because several years after they sold those works of art, they just laid off what seems to be about half their staff.
Are there other museums that are in the same kind of troubled waters because of a possible bankruptcy of a city, or that financial times are very hard in a city? Are there other directors concerned that they could find themselves in the same boat that you've been in this last year and a half?
The DIA has been something of an object lesson. There are approximately a dozen museums whose collections are technically owned by the city. And one, for example, is Birmingham, Alabama. I think Wichita is another, I'm not sure. Certainly the Great Walters Museum in Baltimore is owned by the city. And as far as I know, those the board and the directors are talking to the right people, the mayor and the city council, to get legislation passed that will protect the collection should their cities ever go into bankruptcy.
So lessons certainly that can be learned from what's happened in Detroit. And I'm wondering, how has it been for you as someone who cares for the DIA, loves the DIA, how has it been watching the debate around this bankruptcy? Because it's been so hot and heavy.
Well, it's been stressful. It's also been a little exasperating because there's always been this implication that the works of art would be sold just like that. You know, and they'd be gone tomorrow. And whereas the fact is that legally there would be a long, long battle, and with depending on who it was against, with both sides appealing probably all the way to the Supreme Court. So the notion that the collection would just be sold and entities like Cincora would get their pound of flesh, from my point of view, was not likely to happen at all.
And what did you think last week when the news broke that Cincora was ready to accept an offer from the city and become a partner and drop its opposition to the grand bargain? In fact, earlier today, it reached its settlement with the city, and Cincora actually issued an apology for accusing bankruptcy negotiators of naked favoritism. Were you blindsided by that settlement?
Not entirely. Because we've been part of arbitration, we had picked up the fact that there were other negotiations going on elsewhere. And someone remarked, that they certainly may not be our friends right now, but in the end, they are reasonable people and they recognize facts when confronted with them. And I did, from a very unlikely source, was tipped off a couple of weeks ago that Cincora was giving up on the notion that the collection would be sold. But this was completely unofficial. I had no way of to ratify anything along those lines.
And now this leaves FGIC as the biggest holdout, along with a handful of hedge funds and about 600 individuals. At what point, Director Beal, will you feel that the future of the DIA is indeed safe?
When the judge rules on the plan of adjustment and rules in our favor, and we are able to put into effect the documents that convert the DIA back into a privately held 501c3, which is how we started life in 1883.
Detroit Institute of Arts Director Graham Beal. His director's letter, published in the Detroit Institute of Arts newsletter, can be found at deadlinedetroit.com. Thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Are you one of those travelers who scours the web, checking for the very sweetest prices on all the travel sites, big or small? Well, Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger said all that online hunting might not produce the deals you think they're going to. Ellen, we know these sites, Expedia, Priceline, Travelocity, Hotels.com, so many of them. Do they actually give us a good deal?
They have been, and they still are in some cases. My argument is just that if you're looking for, let's say, just a hotel room or an airfare, just a plain old airfare, there really is no point in checking 10 or 12 or 14 different sites or spending hours on the internet.
Well, and as you say in your story for the Free Press, that these sites have kind of turned into something you called inbred goldfish.
Yes, inbred goldfish and morphing into a giant blob. One of the things is there's continual consolidation in this market. So people may not know, but a lot of these companies are just a few companies and they own each other. So let's say Expedia, they own Hotels.com, Hotwire, Veneer, and Travel Ticker. Priceline owns Kayak and Booking.com. And then Sabre Holdings owns Travelocity, but they just farmed out their search to Expedia. So they all have this kind of, like, I call them inbred goldfish, but
yeah,
that's because they all have these ties and links to each other.
And, you know, it's interesting. I used Booking.com, and very successfully, I must say, to plan a two-week trip for my family. We went around Europe, five countries, and I had all of these reservations. And it was really handy for finding out, for example, gee, what's in Reutte, Austria? Because I want to see King Ludwig's castle. So it showed me hotels. I booked one through them. But then the guest house owner said, you know, the next time, call me directly. I'll give you a better deal.
That's really interesting. And that is true, that sometimes if you just call directly to the property, you can get a better deal than any of these other choices. I mean, you know, there are things like promo codes. I like a new site. It's called alltherooms.com, and it includes sort of a meta search, but it gives you the answers right there. Searches not only hotels, but it also has Airbnb on it and, you know, VRBO and all these different sites all on the same one. It's really fast. I would encourage people to take a look at that.
And it's one of the few independent sites left?
That's correct. There are some independent sites. Airbnb is still independent. That's the checking if you want to stay at somebody's house, although most of them are like vacation rentals now. A site called HipMunk is still an independent site. And the travel ride-sharing companies, Uber and Lyft, are both still independent. I would guess it's only a matter of time before they are bought up by the big boys, or they end up eating each other for breakfast.
Bottom line, Ellen Krieger, is it possible to find and uncover some good deal in airfare or hotel room, or are those days pretty much gone?
With airfare, let's just say a regular flight, you know, Detroit to Seattle, for example, you can check 100 places, and you're basically going to find the exact same fare, because airlines are very carefully controlling the prices and the algorithms that they use for, you know, what they charge for various fares or various days. That doesn't mean you couldn't check Delta.com every day for 6 days and find six different prices. I'm just saying that if you looked at six different sites today, you're probably going to come up with the exact same price on an airfare. But, I mean, I don't want to rain on anybody's parade. You can still find things out there. So just keep looking. Just don't spend too much time looking.
Detroit Free Press travel writer Ellen Krieger. As always, thank you so much, Ellen.
Sure, thanks, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Health insurers and healthcare.gov are now gearing up for year two of the Affordable Care Act. Open enrollment on the exchanges begins 2 months from today. Marianne Udall Phillips is director of the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Marianne, we've already been seeing comments from insurance executives and those who run these online exchanges indicating the nation could be in for a bumpy ride again, because along with the new enrollees signing up for the first time, there'll be customers shopping around to renew or change plans, and there'll be fluctuations in prices of the plans. What's your take?
You know, it's going to be an interesting, exciting time for the next enrollment, because we have all of those 272,000 people who are going through the second year. The administration has allowed people to auto-enroll so they can keep their same plans that they had and just be automatically re-enrolled. But if they had subsidies, and 87% of people in Michigan on the exchange got subsidies, if their income has fluctuated between the first and the second year, that could change their subsidies. That could be a complication. Premium rates have changed, so that could adjust what people are actually paying, and people may not be aware of that. So most of the insurers are actually recommending people re-enroll directly rather than auto-enroll and just keep going forward that way.
And that would be November 15th. And
that would start November 15th.
Start.
That's right.
But unlike last year, when they had to keep kind of moving the goal line and they stretched out the enrollment period because of all the problems with the website, that was 6 months. But this year...
That's right. It's a much shorter enrollment. It starts in November. It's really more like a standard enrollment that most employers go through. And it is because we think it's going to be a more effective enrollment. It's going to be, you know, we think the healthcare.gov website problems that happened that first year, they've clearly been significantly improved. So we don't think we're going to face those problems this year, but there is going to be some confusion, and people are going to... So getting in early and doing it in the first couple months would be a good thing for most people.
So it starts November 15th, and when does the door close?
So it closes 3 months later, so it's a shorter enrollment than we went through last year.
Are you getting any sense of how many plans will be available in Michigan and what the prices might be, or is it too early for that yet?
You know, we haven't seen the full range of plans, but what we do know is that more insurers have decided to offer coverage in the marketplace, and that's pretty exciting as well. So we have several new insurers who are coming into the marketplace, so we expect actually more choices for consumers going forward. In some counties last year, we had 55 different plans that were offered. That's probably going to be higher this year.
But some counties, I know we talked to people from the Upper Peninsula who had very few. Is there going to be some evening out? Will there be more choices?
Well, probably in some of those counties in the UP, it won't change significantly. And that is what happens when you're in a marketplace. You know, it's clear that the insurers are responding to where we have the greatest density of people and where there's the greatest competition between health plans. But some of those counties in the UP had, you know, five plans or less, and usually just one insurer, maybe two in some choices. So their rates were higher. We saw in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan higher rates than in the southeastern part of Michigan.
And that's the marketplace, as you say.
That's exactly right.
And speaking of the marketplace, there are reports coming from around the country that that some companies are going to be building in some pretty significant price hikes. Others are going to say, well, then we're going to lower ours. So the marketplace is working, but consumers, that means they really have to do their homework.
That's exactly right. We saw some of the large health plans actually increase their rates something like 9% from where they were last year on average. You know, I think they looked at who their enrollees were this go-round, and they made some predictions about what their actual utilization would be. You know, healthcare costs aren't really going up very much this year. In fact, it's a record year, along with the past several, of relatively low healthcare costs, still a little higher than inflation, but pretty low. But I think people are looking at the mix of enrollees they got and predicting what their use might be. So some are up, and as you say, some are down. Some looked at their enrollees or looked at what they wanted to do in the marketplace and said, we're going to lower our rates because we want to attract more. So it would be very important for consumers to actually, even those who have coverage now, through the marketplace, look at the choices again and see what is the best match with the premiums and the networks that are offered as well.
And then factor in the fact, as you say, that the tax credit situation could change if your income changed.
That's correct.
So there could be some pleasant or unpleasant surprises depending.
That's exactly right.
Is the information available now for people to go to healthcare.gov and look?
It is not yet. The plans are not yet out there. We expect they will be out there in October, so people can start going to look at it on the website at that point. But and all of the enrollment assisters and counselors that have been out there can certainly help people navigate that again.
You know, Marianne, as we've talked about on this program, one of the biggest unpleasant surprises of year one, apart from the problems with the actual website, were for the people who discovered that their policies had been canceled and policies that they were very happy with, and then the new policies that they were not happy with, they had to take, cost a lot more. And the main answer they got when they asked why was essentially a shrug. And I know this from personal experience with people it happened to.
Yeah.
Do you foresee any more unpleasant surprises this year?
Well, again, it's a marketplace, and so for some people, they are going to face higher premiums, and some people are going to face much lower premiums. Some people will see rates that they thought should be lower than they were, and you know, some of what happens when health plans set their rates is they're making predictions about what the mix of enrollment's going to look like, whether they're getting that mix of people who are relatively healthy and young versus those who might be older and use more services. And so if their mix doesn't look like it's going to be quite what they're expecting, then people might see a rate increase, even though the Affordable Care Act tries to stabilize and has a number of provisions in there that tries to stabilize those rates. So might not be as bad as last year, but there will be some.
Marianne Udall-Phillips, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
And you as well.
Marianne directs the Center for Healthcare Research and Transformation at the University of Michigan. Climate change could have huge effects on birds in North America. That's according to a new report from the National Audubon Society. It finds within the next 65 years, about half of our 650 species could be forced to find totally new places to live or become extinct. Jonathan Lutz is executive director of the Michigan Audubon Society. What did you think when this report was released from National?
Well, I was startled, Cindy. We certainly have birds in the state of Michigan that we care very deeply about. And of course, we have birds worldwide that we care deeply about. And Birds face a great diversity of threats, and to say climate change is the single greatest threat to birds worldwide, that's a pretty remarkable statement.
And that's really what this is saying. Of all the kinds of things, humans moving into their habitats or whatever, it's climate change that's the biggest threat.
Absolutely. We can nail down, you know, a dozen of the top threats to birds, but climate change outweighs all of them. Without addressing climate and how it relates to the basic elements that birds need to survive, all of the other issues are moot.
Give us a sense of the scope of the challenge posed by climate change to the birds.
Sure. So the National Audubon Society took several decades of information, and we looked at three basic elements of temperature, precipitation, and changing seasons. And what that allowed the Audubon scientists to do was to model shifts in geographic range where birds currently occur and where they'll occur over the period, you know, between now and the end of the century.
And you found?
What we found were some pretty startling results. Of the 588 species that the study focused on, that's the majority of birds that occur in the lower 48, Canada, and Alaska, found that about half of those birds are either climate threatened or climate endangered. In the case of climate threatened, that means that their ranges will shift and possibly allow birds to move and populate new areas. In the case of climate endangered, without addressing the climate change issue, we could be losing those bird species.
What about here in Michigan? Which bird species are the most vulnerable? Or do we have any threatened, climate-threatened ones in Michigan?
Absolutely. We have both climate-threatened and climate-endangered birds. And for the state of Michigan, we're talking about 50 species. And perhaps the most iconic on the list is the common loon, symbol of the north. Most of us are at least familiar with the image of a loon if we haven't seen one of the lakes in the northern lower peninsula or in the upper peninsula. The common loon is one of these climate endangered species.
How about threatened?
Along the climate threatened line, we're talking about some common backyard birds that we see either in the summer months or year-round. Two to come to mind are the scarlet tanager. That's a summer visitor. And the white-breasted nuthatch. That's a bird that I enjoy seeing in my neighborhood in East Lansing on a year-round basis.
Could we see species that really are southern, warm weather identified moving into the Great Lakes?
It's possible, but before we jump to sort of that conclusion, mm-hmm. It's important to note with range shift, that indicates that birds could be moving, but as we know, trees don't move. So a bird that depends on grassland, for instance, if its range is shifting northward into the boreal forest, the basic elements for survival that it needs may not be present there.
So thus that threat of extinction.
Absolutely.
Well, then, is there anything that can be done now when you think 65 years really isn't very long? Is this inevitable?
I think there's a message of hope here. Birds are extremely resilient. I can tell you that at least three or four times a week we get phone calls at my office of people reporting bald eagles. I saw a bald eagle today. And in 2008, we removed the bald eagle from the state endangered species list. That's a great success story for conservation. So we know that birds have the ability to bounce back if we are willing to commit to the right changes. In the case of climate change in birds, there are two major things that we can do. We can protect the areas that are conservation strongholds, the areas that species depend on and need the most, and support a diversity of species. The other thing that we need to get aggressive on is reducing carbon emissions.
Do you fear that we're at a point where it's too late?
I don't. I think it's easy sometimes to indulge in that fear. Mm-hmm. But we are, we're an advanced society. We have strong political willpower. And if we're willing to make the change to remove ourselves from depending on fossil fuels and adapt new energy, low emission philosophies in terms of our energy consumption, that will benefit birds and the birds will rebound.
And when we talk about preserving bird species in their homes where they are now, this is beyond just, gee, it's nice to see them, or I love the sound of their singing in the morning. We're really talking about, for example, agriculture.
I think to pull back a little bit from that, birds are indicators of our own health and well-being. They signal changes in the environment, and when birds are doing well, that's usually going to indicate that we're living in a healthy world. So if we think of birds as sort of bellwethers for the choices and decisions that we make, both on an individual scale but also on a societal scale, then it's a mutually beneficial relationship. And so even if you're not a bird lover, you don't feed birds in your backyard, you don't chase birds around the state or the United States or the world, think of birds as, you know, the signals for your healthy community, for your healthy neighborhood, and for your healthy state of Michigan.
Jonathan Lutz is Executive Director of the Michigan Audubon Society. Jonathan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
The Aeron chair. It's the instantly recognizable mesh-backed ergonomic office chair. Nearly 7 million Aerons have been sold to date by the Herman Miller Company of West Michigan.
The state of Michigan.
Ensuring quality products today.
But the chair that epitomizes today's office actually began life as something designed for a completely different consumer. Don Chadwick and Bill Stumpf designed the Aeron for the Herman Miller Company, and Don Chadwick joins us now from Los Angeles. Don, good to talk with you.
Thank you. Good to talk to you as well.
When you first began designing what ultimately became the Aeron, you and Bill didn't have office warriors in mind, did you?
Well, Bill and I believe that what had been done before and what was currently available wouldn't satisfy our approach. So we set out to take a totally different look at how an office chair worked and how it looked and how it responds to the environment it's to be used in.
What was it about the existing chairs that you just looked at and said, no, that's not going to be my chair?
Well, to be blunt, a lot of them were boring because they were predictable.
And you wanted something that really was distinct. What do you believe works about the Aeron? I mean, why are there 17 million of them or so in offices around the country?
The uniqueness of the chair, obviously, is the woven suspension, because it broke away from the traditional use of foam and fabric on office chairs. Just looking at the chair, the image that you have is this semi-transparent chair with a minimal amount of support surface.
I'm looking at one now. So you're right. Minimal amount. And I've got to imagine environmentally, we're all a lot better off than without all that foam.
Exactly. I think it was one of the first products Herman Miller consciously helped develop that cut back on a lot of the materials that didn't lend themselves to environmentalists.
Don Chadwick, as a designer, what does it feel like for you to see something that you conceived with your partner Bill and your design partner, and you labored over this, and now it's pretty omnipresent. It's really a part of the culture. What does that feel like?
I feel flattered, and I traveled quite a bit, and it's interesting that you can find those chairs as far away as Iceland and Scandinavia and in Asia. It's really a worldwide chair.
Well, on behalf of office workers everywhere who more and more now we're sitting, you know, we're not moving around too much at the office because we're chained to our laptops. And so on behalf of bottoms all over the world, we want to say thank you, Don Chadwick.
Well, you're very welcome. I appreciate talking to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is known as the skills gap, and we've heard it talked about here on Stateside. Employers who say they just cannot find the skilled workers they need to fill available jobs. But other voices speak up to question the sales gap. They call it overblown, even a myth. Let's talk more about this now as we welcome Luke Glazer, who's president and co-founder of Michigan Future, and George Erichek, who's senior regional analyst at the Upjohn Institute. Gentlemen, welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Thank you.
George, a couple weeks back, we had the head of the Michigan Home Builders Association on this program, and he said, boy, builders in Michigan are having a hard time finding the workers to meet their demand. It's slowing down the pace of home building. And then we hear experts like Peter Capelli at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania say this skills gap's a myth, and it's really more the fault of the companies. What are your thoughts on this?
My thought about the home industry, the home construction trade, is that it went through the ringer, and a lot of good employees finally said, that's it. This recession really hit the housing market extremely hard. And I think there's been a lot of people that have simply left the industry. So there is a shortage of workers because workers really want stability. And what they've experienced during this horrible crisis was 2 or 3 years that they've never seen before. Hopefully, we'll never see again, but will be very difficult to persuade them to go into an industry that is so cyclical.
Lou, is it more a matter of the kinds of jobs that we're talking about, that there are some jobs where, yes, there is a skills gap, like these skilled jobs in the home trades, and others where perhaps it's overblown?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think in general, we have ended up with an analysis that is largely driven by sort of some group of employers complaining that they want government to do something about what is their perceived problem, that they can't find the right people for the work kind of thing. And what's got lost in all of this stuff is that by and large, employers seem to have forgotten that they're buyers and sellers like every other marketplace. And that if you're a buyer and you don't have sellers, it's your responsibility to make the position more attractive. So employers, I think, don't want to do that, and yet that's the only way the market is going to work. So either wages have to go up, which is a way of attracting people. Work conditions have to change. You have to offer more stability. A lot of people in construction, I know, work sort of every once in a while 19-hour days and don't want to work 19-hour days. Mm. But by and large, to me, the danger in that story that's being told is that it is starting again to distort sort of the reality of what's going on structurally in the labor market, which is that more and more jobs require higher skills and particular college-educated skills, and that if you're looking for sort of stable work, working more, earning more, increasingly that's what is characteristic of folks who have four-year degrees, not folks who don't have four-year degrees.
You know, it is interesting. I got some emails from folks after we had that conversation on the skills gap and pointing out very accurately that it's way too easy to find folks in our state who've been laid off as companies downsize, and they have the skills, they want to work, and they cannot find a full-time job doing that and paying what they've been making, so they wind up cobbling together a living with contract work and part-time jobs, neither offering benefits. And meantime, we have business execs talking about the skills gap. So are we saying we need to take a big chunk of salt with what these business execs are saying because it's really more about the hiring practices and what they're paying?
I think that's true. I think that many are still using temporary employment services. So what they do with the temporary employment agencies is it's a really nice way to see if the person can do the work. And if they can't, they can easily get rid of them. However, it provides increased uncertainty to the individual. The wage structures, as Lou has said, should be moved up. We have seen evidence now that wages are increasing. But I think it's a challenge is that it's a very tough sell for someone who is just coming out of high school to be sold into a manufacturing environment. They just have to look at the numbers. They have to look at the numbers of the cycle, the business cycle, and the long-term trend downward. At the same time, manufacturing is extremely important to our state. And so therefore, the survival of manufacturing does depend on a good workforce. So to me, the real challenge is if you're a manufacturer and you're trying to find that skilled worker you want, and you have to pay the wages, but also provide the work environment, which maybe you will not be able to do. The wages, probably yes. The work environment, you're going to be dependent upon your orders. And manufacturing orders, by definition almost, are cyclical. So yes, right now it's great. Next year, I bet it's going to be a very good year. Not so clear about 2017. So how do you say to someone who's 18, come work with me and I can provide you at least 2 years of employment. I sure hope to keep you forever. I just don't know because I'm victim to this business cycle.
Right. And a lot of these kids have grown up in families where the father, the uncle, and older brother worked in either manufacturing or construction and have gone through a couple of decades of frequent layoff, if not absolute job loss. it's very hard at that point to say to the kid, boy, this is a good path, when they've grown up in a household where they and their family have sort of suffered from that. So, and then you add to it, so construction, which is even more seasonal work than the manufacturing, but both are very cyclical. One of the ways that construction workers used to make a year-round living was, as Michigan had generous unemployment insurance benefits, which the corporate community has now basically shredded, so that we've got the lowest unemployment insurance benefits now in the country. So once again, when you look at the package that employers have put together to attract people to the industry, it ain't so great. And when it ain't so great, you're going to get a smaller pool of entrants. I mean, that's just the way markets work.
So how do we fix this disconnect between employers saying we can't find them and, as you say, many workers, especially the younger workers, feeling pretty queasy about following in the manufacturing or the skilled trades?
Well, I guess my feelings in the long run is we have to look at the products being made. And that's where I think, with Lou arguing that we really do need talent, we need design engineers and we need engineer designers. We need people on really high skilled levels to be able to produce the products that the changing world wants to need. And once those products are designed, hopefully they would be produced here. So my feelings is, if you want a better manufacturing workforce, the wage structure has to always be maintained, but also the stability. The stability comes with product design, comes with the product that is being produced. And so therefore, when I think about engineers and I think about designers, industrial designers, I'm kind of think that they are the lifeline to that 45-year-old working mom who's working on the line producing a product, because that job's going to hold as long as that product is up to market specs.
They keep turning out products that the company can sell and
that's
someone
right.
wants to buy.
And the only way you can do that is through product design and good engineering. So I see the whole skill spectrum being very key, that you have to have those engineers, you have to have those designers, which fortunately West Michigan has a lot of, and that if those folks work on the products that's being generated in the state, there's a much greater probability that their market share will be maintained.
So, Lou, what is the role of schools in training these kids coming out to be able to take these jobs and not the ones that don't have the future?
Right. At least I make a distinction between K-12 and post-secondary. And part of the K-12 conversation is as much moral as it is economic. So the question is, you know, the country has been moving away from, and now seems to have some questions about whether that was the right thing to do, moving away from sort of vocational training in high school. I think what the notion being, at least our notion, I think a lot of people's notion is that you really want all kids graduating from high school where they have as many opportunities to pursue as adults as possible, as opposed to high school sort of narrowing the opportunities for them.
So, for example, cutting vocational ed.
Right. So, you know, from my perspective, it is a good thing.
To cut vocational ed?
Exactly. So I think you want, at least from our perspective in K-12, you want to build broad skills, not narrow skills. Mm-hmm. So the Common Core is, you know, is at the epicenter of that movement. Common Core is sort of college prep on steroids. It really expects all kids in a K-12 education to build a very broad set of skills so that when they leave high school, they have all opportunities available to them. Post-high school, you want good vocational training program for those who want to go into those careers, as well as professional and managerial training for those who want to go into those careers. And it's interesting, if you look at kids who choose to pursue sort of more technical skilled trades occupations after high school, either at a community college or in a vocational training program, the biggest barrier to success is that they have not built academic foundation skills in K-12. These are now increasingly high-skilled jobs. If you're not able to do fairly high-order math, some reading, writing, communication skills, the fact that you want to be a plumber, you're not going to be a plumber. But not because you don't have the interest, but because you haven't built sort of the foundation skills. So we view K-12 education as building broad foundation skills in all kids and then allowing kids to specialize after high school in whatever they're interested in.
And not necessarily we hear quite the drumbeat for four-year degree, four-year degree, four-year degree. Not always.
Right. But you want all kids to have a realistic option to pursue it, as opposed to some adult in high school saying to your kid, you're not college material, but George's kid is college material. You really want the kid to make that choice, not some adult.
And I guess this is where kind of Lou and I do have a disagreement. It's a very modest one, but I think there's different learning styles, and some kids learn better hands-on.
Right.
And so they are able to work in a more technical environment and get the core training
sure.
needs that's possible. So a lot of what we found is a lot of kids do very, very well in technical training in learning core applications of mathematics and even writing ability. So I think that high school should be more broad than maybe what Lou is suggesting. In the sense, I do think technical training in high school can serve as an effective tool for education for some kids. Myself, I was not a hands-on guy. I was more into book reading and doing problem sets. But others who are equally smart really liked the idea of hands-on applications. And the real challenge we have, I think, is when we look in the future, and what you'd be surprised about is how there's so much strong disagreement about the future. What will be the jobs of the future?
Right.
And looking at BLS and what the Bureau of Labor Statistics is saying, 2025, there will be 50 million more jobs. 50 million more jobs nationwide. 17 million will require a bachelor's degree or higher. 33 million jobs will not. We should work hard to make sure none of those jobs are filled by Michiganders. I mean, the real challenge is there are a lot of bad jobs out there, and those bad jobs are growing. And if kids do not attach in high school, they don't really succeed in high school, there's employment opportunities for them. Those employment opportunities are going to be low wage for the rest of their lives.
Right.
And so what we really need with high school, I think, is to broaden not only the core subjects, but the technical training as well. If it works for a kid to work with his or her hands, to be able then to go and get a certificate or a two-year degree, let's do it. Let's not. So my feelings are that what Lou was saying may be a little bit too restrictive in high school, and the fact that there are different learning styles that we should pay attention to.
So circling back to where we began this conversation, if I say skills gap in Michigan, Lou, what does it mean to you, or is there one?
Well, I think if there is a skill gap, it is, you know, what wages are telling us is that we have too few people with four-year degrees. If you believe that price is what brings supply and demand into equilibrium, which is sort of the foundation of free market economics, the price gap between four-year degrees and everybody else is growing, not shrinking, which is the normal way of saying that we've got more demand than supply. So if there is a skill gap writ large, the skill gap is that we don't have enough people for the third of the jobs that are going to require a four-year degree. So let's just assume for the moment that the third's right, and I agree with George, predicting future jobs is really hard. It's
sure.
not easy at all. But let's assume that a third is about right. At the moment, there's 28% of Americans who have a four-year degree. The difference between 28% and 33% is actually pretty darn big. So if there is a skill gap, that's where really the broader skill gap exists. It does not exist in the non-college or the non-four-year degree jobs. I believe that the evidence of a skill gap is rising wages, period. If wages aren't rising, you don't have a skill gap, where wages in general aren't rising at all. But where they're the highest and where the gap is the greatest is in the highest skilled jobs, not in these mid-skilled jobs, and certainly not in the low-skilled jobs.
Lou's right. It's market demand. If the wages aren't going up, there isn't any evidence of a shortage. Now, what we are seeing on the west side of the state, our wages are going up. So that's good news. Mm-hmm. But when you do talk to employers, I'm sure if you get employers in here, especially manufacturers, they will argue that they cannot find workers. I was telling Lou earlier that I've heard for the first time in 5 years the phrase, if you fog a mirror, you're in. It looks like manufacturers are just looking for warm bodies to be on the assembly line. That's a tricky proposition because that job may not last more than 2 or 3 years. My feelings are, yes, I think we are looking at a labor shortage that may be in more levels than Lou thinks. That I think it could be on the short end as well as the high end.
Fascinating conversation. I guess as we try to think of how to put this together, is this fixable? And how important is it that it gets fixed for Michigan's economy, Lou?
Sure. So our central belief is that the asset that matters most to long-term economic growth is human capital, that basically this is, it probably always has been, but I think increasingly is a talent-driven economy. So I think it matters enormously. The only way this stuff is fixable, it seems to me, is going back to the four trade schools, which is, and I'm using that as an example of what I think is the right way to organize sort of occupational training, which is that companies take responsibility for the development of their own sort of talent pool as opposed to socializing it. I mean, at some point, companies decided they were going to get out of the business of preparing people for the work, and they said, gee, it's the government's responsibility. I'm not exactly sure that it is the government response. And the four trade schools worked wonderfully. Not only did they produce skilled tradespeople, but I've had the experience in working with Southeast Michigan suppliers, and a lot of the owners came out of the Ford trade school. So it was pretty entrepreneurial as well. So if companies, instead of complaining about someone else preparing their talent, should really start once again to take responsibility.
George, final word for you.
I agree with what Lou said. I think the four trade schools were great. I also like us to spend more public money into public education.
Amen.
That I think that we have shortchanged K through 12, the community colleges, and the universities. And Lou is right. Talent is going to be the competitive edge to our state as all other states. And as long as we keep on starving the public schools on all levels of resources, we're not going to be very happy with the results.
Correct.
George Arakchuk is Senior Regional Analyst at the Upjohn Institute, and Lou Glaser, President and Co-Founder of Michigan Future. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in and talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
And we would love to get your comments and thoughts on the skills gap and other stories you hear on Stateside. Very easy to find us. Go to Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, or always at michiganradio.org, and just click the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our director today was Allie Billings, and engineer was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.